This is Jonathan Philpott. It is February 23rd. I'm at the American Legion with David Green. It's 11:46 a.m. and we're going to talk about his time in the military. If you don't mind, just start by giving your date of birth and occupation, and then just introduce yourself, whatever you want to say.
Okay, I'm David Green, and I was born December 22nd, 1923, and went into military service in April of 43. Yeah, and I was discharged in January of 46. Now, after the war, I was in construction work for a while, and then I decided a change in career would be advisable, or just be nice to have. And I'd always flown, so I'd already had a pilot's license, so I took over the Mount Sterling Airport and ran it for almost 20 years. Then my hearing started going bad, and I retired and started fishing.
Okay. When you went into the military, did you choose to enlist, or were you drafted, or?
I wasn't drafted. I was a sophomore in engineering at Purdue, and I was going to be drafted, and so I found out if I joined the Enlisted Reserve Corps, the ERC, I'd go in about the same time as being drafted, but I would have a better chance of getting the branch of service I wanted. And since I'd been in ROTC at Purdue in artillery, I knew more about that, and I thought, well, that's a pretty good fit. And so then I joined the ERC, and I wound up in artillery after I was called in. That let me finish up my sophomore year in college.
Okay. Where did you go to boot camp?
Went there at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and we did our training on the 155 millimeter rifle, long rifles, or long toms, they called them, because you didn't shoot them very much, cost too much. But they made one heck of a racket when you shot them, and no hearing aids or hearing dampeners of any kind. Back in those days, you held your hand over the ears, and that was it. And I think that's where my hearing actually got it started, going downhill.
Okay. From there, where did they send you?
They sent me back to college. If you were an engineer and your AGCT score was high enough, and you were training in something that they thought might be essential in the future, they had this ASTP program, Army Specialized Training Program. And the Army had it called ASTP. The Navy had their own training program. They called it something else. And it sent us back to college. I went to Clemson this time. And the thing about it, the first semester I had repeated what I'd done the last year in Purdue. The second semester, I got into some new stuff. But at the end of the second semester, which came along just before the invasion in June of 44, they decided to disband that program. They were going to need all of us anyway. And so instead of saving all our bright brains, they thought they were saving, they sent us went to the airborne. And so I shipped out of there then and went to the 13th Airborne Division in Camp McCall, North Carolina, which is adjacent to Fort Bragg, but which had been an airborne base since its inception.
Okay. that's really surprising they did that, sort of.
But. Sure.
So that's surprising that they chose to do that. But.
Well, they did. The funny thing about it, I ran into people there, a good friend of mine that I'd known at Purdue, but he had taken his basic training in California. And we wound up in the same same battalion, artillery battalion.
So what did they do with you after they sent you to airborne training?
Well, we went through airborne training in gliders, which consisted, there's a whole lot, of course, of physical education. And we'd run for 5 miles, and we'd force march for 25 and do all that stuff. And then in the glider part, of course, a glider soldier and an airborne, a paratrooper, both are just soldiers. They just get there a different way. And I think they probably might have been a little bit tougher on airborne training than they were on the regular training, because we were supposed to go way out and be out on our own for a good while before they caught up with us. We weren't supposed to win anything. We were just supposed to raise teetotal cane back behind the lines is the purpose of it, and make the enemy so nervous that they couldn't really, they didn't know exactly where people were. And that would give the main ground forces a chance to break through and come on and rescue us. We were supposed to be rescued after 3 days. But after we actually got into the glider riding part of it, they scared me so bad, I volunteered to jump. Because glider people were not volunteers. They were put in there. If you jumped out of an airplane, you had to volunteer for that. And besides that, you got a $50 a month raise, which helped. And so anybody in the division that wanted to take parachute training, become qualified parachutists, was allowed to. And we all went down to the Airborne Center in Fort Benning in the summer of 44 and went through jump school. And of course, doing that, you wound up making 5 parachute jumps, and you learn how to pack your own parachute, do all this other stuff. And then you're awarded your wings, and you get, my pay got doubled from a private at $54 a month to $104, I think I was getting $54 as a PFC at that time. And then we went back to our division, except I got a change in jobs after that. I'd been in what they call the wire section, which communications, which we learned how to run around on our bellies back in behind the lines and string wire. And I was changed then to S2, which is intelligence. And I don't mean I'm very intelligent. Probably wouldn't have been there if I had been. But my purpose changed in the thing. I was moved from A battery to headquarters battery and put into S2 division of it. We would go in with the parachute infantry ahead of the gliders and help establish, try to get a little intelligence on where the enemy was and where we could set up our batteries and do this and that and the other. It was the purpose of the whole thing. Go in there a little bit in advance and kind of prepare the way for the gliders, so we kind of tell them what the lay of the land was. And then their same outfit would come and join us later with the gliders if they got there. Gliders had a bad habit of crashing. And every time we flew them, we would tear some up. And that was under, not under combat. But they were big, bulky things. They carried a lot of weight. And when they cut loose from that plane, they were coming down. And if they got cut loose in the right place and they could find a place to land, they were in good shape. If for some reason they got cut loose in the wrong place, they were just kind of bad. And, go ahead.
I was going to say, so what did they do, where did they send you once you finished the jump school? The only real note I have says you're in France.
Okay. After jump school, we went back and finished up our training at Camp McCall. And we had our final maneuvers in September or October, I can't remember which, of 44. And after that, we were declared combat ready. And the only thing is, we were ready to ship overseas, but they couldn't find a place in the convoy for us. So we didn't actually ship out until January of 45. And that probably saved a lot of our lives. If we'd gotten over there when we were ready, we'd have been prime targets to go to the Battle of the Bulge. That took place in December of 45. And we had not had any combat. And we were probably the best trained division the Army had, because we were the last division just about formed. I know it was the last airborne division formed. And so we took it, had advantage of the mistakes they'd made earlier during the invasion and in other places. And so we had probably the best training of anybody. Anyhow, we got there and we went in at Le Havre, France. And that place was bombed beyond recognition. There wasn't anything left but a pile. Well, we'd bombed it before we went in there. They'd bulldozed the streets out. The wharves were gone. We had a floating wharf they brought over there. They unloaded us on a boat and took us ashore the rest of the way in smaller vessels. Of course, the fighting was all over with there. They would have been captured 3 or 4 months ahead of time. And we were in, I forget the name of the camp. They had camp Lucky Strike in Chesterfield and different ones over there that you would go to while they were getting things ready to ship you on out to where your final destination was. We were there for several days. And I liked to starve to death, both on the boat and at that camp. We got 2 meals a day on the boat, and I was hungry. I wasn't seasick or anything until one time. I had tongue, and everybody else was sick and couldn't eat their tongue, and I ate about 2 or 3 different people's portion of tongue, and then I got sick. So I haven't eaten tongue since.
Is that cow tongue? Or?
No, it's beef tongue. I don't know. I never heard it served anywhere else. It is what it was. But anyhow, that finally finished me up.
Did they have a mess hall on the ship?
Well, on a troop ship, they were converted liners, and most of them, I think, were. And we had hammocks to sleep in. I don't remember if we had a hammock or a bunk bed, to tell the truth. You got it for 8 hours. Somebody else got it for 8, and the third person got it for the third 8. And the rest of the time, you had to just make yourself scarce and go wherever you could on board the ship to kind of stay out of the way. But they really hadn't had it loaded up heavy. That's where I saw my first whale. Right in the middle of a convoy, there came a whale floating along, spouting. So that was exciting.
Yeah, imagine. So, let's see. You're really doing great so far. I mean, don't wait on me to ask you a question. You're really doing wonderful. When you got to the camp, what did they feed you there?
At Le Havre, it wasn't enough, because I remember one time, I always had a big appetite. I dropped a piece of bread in the mud, and you had to go and get this, and then you had to go back to your tent where you were sleeping. Somewhere I dropped part of my bread in the mud, and I picked it up, scraped it off, and ate it anyway. I've never been that hungry before or since, but it was just me. Yeah, I remember it was cold. Yeah, very cold there. We were sleeping in tents. We had some kind of a stove in there. After that, we moved us out, and we went through Paris. We put us in these, you've heard of these 48 cars, 40 soldiers or 8 horses or something like that. And they had about 40 of us in there. And it was full. I mean, and we were in there for 2 days, I think. We went through one thing that happened, we went through the railroad yards in Paris, and we were there for a while they were shipping trains around one thing, nothing. And not too far over from us, there was a car with some big, great big vats of wine. And somebody got the idea that we ought to get some of that wine. We figured out what it was and how to get into it. And we all wound up with canteens full of wine. And it got back then, somebody said somebody stole all our wine and came back to us. And they had an awful time getting that straightened out, but nobody would ever admit to anything. But that time everybody sobered up by the time they found out. So we didn't get caught on that. When we moved on from there, my outfit, it was the 677th Glider Field Artillery Battalion, we went to a place called Joigny. It's on the Yonne River, just south of Paris. And that was where we were going to be for a while, our base for the time being. It had originally been a French caserne, which was kind of a walled fort with a nice place, built out of brick. We had everything convenience in the world there. We had places for training, had big mess halls, big barracks. And of course, after the Germans took it over, but they had been gone a couple of months before we got there. And so were there the French and then the Germans and then the Americans took it. Now the French, I understand, are used it again, still. The rest of our division part of them went to Sens, S-E-N-S, France, and the rest of them, part of them, then went to Auxerre, France. And they were all within a station with about 20 miles of each other. So we could, I think they had sort of similar conditions to live in that we had. But went back to training again. And again, I remember one time they had introduced a new type of ammunition. I think it's a pozite shell. It was supposed to go off when it got so close to the ground, somehow or other it could do that. Well, we were doing a training exercise and I was acting as a forward observer on a ridge, and they were shooting overhead. And even though they shot them too low, they started going off right over top of us. And that was the closest I came to getting wounded, right there with our own shell. But after we'd been over there a month or two, we were assigned, total time we were over there, I think we were assigned three missions. One of them, because we didn't really know what we were doing most of the time, the regular dog faces did. We were just, officers did, but we were supposed to go and they'd tell us what to do when we got there. And you think you do all this training and mock up and all that stuff, and we didn't. But one of our missions was to cross the Rhine and kind of soften up on the other side of the Rhine. And it got canceled because about that time Patton was going like a bat out of hell up through there, and he overran a drop zone. He crossed around on his own. Everything got, he just kept going. And another one was the same thing on another river, and I forget the name of that river. And it was called off at the last minute. And the third one, we really didn't know exactly what it was till later on. The Germans had a place in Germany where they were working on the atomic bomb. They had a heavy water plant there, and they had a bunch of scientists there. And our job, we were getting pretty close, and the headquarters higher up were afraid the scientists would get scattered. And we wanted them bad. And so our job was to go in there and and quietly try to capture all those scientists, and so we'd have ourselves, and Russia didn't get them, really, is what it amounted to. Somehow nobody told the Free French Army, Leclerc's army. He didn't get the word he wasn't supposed to go busting through there. And they got to rolling, and they overran that damn place before we got there. And we were already loaded up in the airplanes on that one. And we had to unload when that started, they could see what was happening, so we never did take off. And they got scattered, the scientists did. They got a few of them, but Leclerc really, I don't understand that, but the only reason I can figure we won the war is because the Germans screwed up worse than we did in a lot of stuff. Because we did a lot of stuff that wouldn't, communication is one thing. Of course, you've got three or four countries working together, and it's hard, I guess, to get everything coordinated like it should be. Anyhow, they eventually got most of them back. They got them later. But Hitler was working on that atomic bomb right along with us. Yeah. And that, to my knowledge, that is the last mission we were assigned. There were three of them altogether. And we didn't do any of them. So we were there, the highest trained division. And the thing, and never had heard a shot fired in anger, which actually, looking back on it, was probably pretty nice, probably lucky. We were known as Lucky 13th. After that, it wasn't long till the war was over. And of course, we were low point people, because you got out of the Army after the war was over on one of the points you had. I'm sure you've heard all this before.
Well, I haven't on tape, so to speak.
Yeah.
So if you don't mind explaining the point system briefly, that would be good.
Mm-hmm. You got so much for your longevity, you got so much for each battle you'd been in, and so much for being overseas. And so if you had high points, you had a good chance of getting that. Of course, the war was over there. We had low points, because we hadn't been overseas very long. We had no combat. I think we had one battle star, and we never did know what that was from, but they said put that on. And so we were either set up for the Army of Occupation or go to Japan, invasion of Japan. Well, since we had all the equipment and our stuff was all in good shape and everything, we wound up going to Japan. Well, it's headed that way. We didn't get on board, and again, getting a convoy back to the States. It was August before we actually got started back to the States. And our thing was, come back through the state, get 30 days home, and assemble on the West Coast, and ship out. And their plans were all made to do that. We got in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. They dropped the bombs. After that, pretty soon after that, the Japanese surrendered. The war was over. And so there we were. We came back into New York Harbor, good old Statue of Liberty sitting up there, and the war was over. They didn't know what to do with us then. It's too expensive to send us back overseas when you already had a lot of people there. And already there. And so then we got our 30 days at home, and then went back to where we'd started out from, at Camp McCall, North Carolina. It was in early winter, fall I guess, of 45. And then they just kept us, and we trained and did one thing. Then everybody wanted to get out and go home, really. And so they were discharging people. In the meantime, I'd made a mistake. When I registered and signed into the Army, I put on there I was a typist. I could type, but I never could type very well. I typed worse than I did then. But our battalion clerk had high points. He'd come from somewhere else and he had high points. He got out. And they looked on that and said, would you like to be clerk? And I said, I don't think so. And they said, because the war was over by that time, and everybody was playing, and we were playing games and basketball and volleyball and baseball and doing a little bit of training along the side. Everybody had a pretty good time. Hell, they gave me another stripe, and I had to go, at that time, it made me a T4, I think, technician, fourth grade. And I became the battalion clerk. Everybody else was playing, and I was working my tail off. So that was a mistake that I made. I never put typing on anything else again.
Yeah.
So came back, I was still pretty busy getting discharges ready and taking care of all this stuff. And then when the 82nd Airborne came back, which the 82nd and 101st were the two most battle, whether you were going to call it combat, no troops in there. And they had a lot of high point men in. Of course, they had a lot of their high point men, or older men, of course, that weren't there anymore. They'd been either killed or wounded. But they came back, and they had a big parade down New York, Fifth Avenue in New York. They didn't have enough people to make the parade, so I didn't go. Again, I'd missed out on the fun because I was a clerk. We had to change our patches on the shoulder, put 82nd Airborne patches. We went up there and met the 82nd, marched down Fifth Avenue like the victors. A lot of our people did. Now, this was, I think, in November, maybe. Or it could have been December. Then things went on, and in January, late in January of 46. Now I was discharged in about the middle of middle of January in 46. The 82nd Airborne absorbed the 13th. The 13th ceased to exist, and all the remaining people were absorbed into the 82nd Airborne, which of course is still going. It's right today. They're in and out of Iraq all the time. The 82nd, I guess, is the only one that's still kind of like the ones we had in World War II. Mainly parachute. They don't use gliders anymore. They just proved lost too many men with them. So they're mainly shock troops, and all parachute trained, of course. And they're kind of kin to special forces in a way. Now, my old camp, we were down there, had a reunion at Fort Bragg. My Army division had a reunion at Fort Bragg several years ago, and we went back to old Camp McCall, which had been the airborne camp. And now it's still active. You don't hear much about it. That's where Special Forces train. They also have conducted a survival school there in Camp McCall. The survival school is not just for the Army, it's for all and civilians, anybody that's subject to be captured by the enemy in any time, or enemy or a friend or whoever they call them anymore. And they go through this survival course there. It's several months long, I think. Some don't make it. And those that do wind up losing about 15 or 20 or 30 pounds. It's just that tough, because you have to learn a lot, and you have to be in the woods a lot by your own and living on your own wits and everything. And that's what's going on at Camp McCall right now. Like I say, they don't advertise it like they do these other places, but it's there, and it's still going strong. And it's adjacent to Fort Bragg. And anyhow, that winds up in my military service pretty much.
Okay. Well, let me look at some of these. These are just, you know, sort of sample questions that we're not going to try to run through all, or probably even most of them. But let me see if there's anything specific from them I'd like to ask. That was really great, though. That's the best kind of interview when I don't have to talk a lot. Let's see. Did you leave anybody behind when you got drafted, as far as girlfriend, parents, anything like that?
Well, yeah, I did. I was pinned to a girl I'd met at Purdue. And anyhow, I think it was right after I got to France, I got my Dear John letter and my pen back. Probably the best thing that ever happened to me. I didn't think so at the time, but looking back, well, I think I wouldn't have met my wife if I hadn't done that, and I couldn't beat her.
So, I guess then you weren't getting letters from home from the girlfriend for the most part.
I got plenty of letters from home, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I got them from her for a while, but then she met somebody else. She wound up, went out to Mills College. She was younger than I was. I met her through a fraternity brother. And she went up at Mills College out in California and met somebody out there that she thought would be more suitable for her. And I sure hope so.
Okay, let's see. Is there anything that happened at home that you missed that, you know, births, deaths, you know, anything like that you wished you'd been here for? Or?
No, actually, it probably is not supposed to say this, but I rather enjoyed my military time. I got out and I got to see a lot of stuff I wouldn't have seen otherwise. I was very lucky. I never got hurt. The only closest I came to getting hurt was on that night parachute jump on maneuvers. Landed in a tree, pitch black dark, and I didn't know it, but I hit my leg on a branch coming down, I guess. Because when you make a land in a tree, not much you can do about it. You put your legs close together, really close together, and cover your face up, and that's it. You go down through there the best you can. Something gagged a hole in my leg, and I didn't even know it. The 2 days later, it started hurting. I pulled my pants leg up, and I could see the bone. Oh. It had set in, so I found a medic. I thought I was wounded in terrible shape. He filled it full of sulfur powder and put a Band-Aid or something on it and said, go on back, you're all right. And it was. It healed up, never did give me any trouble at all. Sulfur powder was a great thing at that time.
Do they not use that anymore? The sulfur powder, do they still use that, or do you know?
I'm sorry?
Do they still use that powder, or do you
know?
Yeah,
they use sulfur powder. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because we carried it with us all the time, too. And had a little thing on there.
Okay. Let's see. Other than that, that battle star, did you get any other medals or anything?
Oh, I got a good conduct medal. I wonder why that. Sometimes I wonder why they gave it to me, because my conduct went all that good a lot of the time. But,
I was going to ask you, I've heard quite a lot about pranks, you know, people playing pranks on each other. Did you all play jokes or anything on each other since while you in your downtime?
I don't recall any big pranks going on. We were really fairly serious people at that time. Of course, I won't say we didn't go out and drink every chance we got, which we did. But as far as the training and so forth, it was just a pretty serious bunch of people.
Okay. Let's see. Some of these questions are kind of funny, given you know how you've told me you're really lucky and didn't have to, you know.
Mm-hmm. We didn't think so at the time. We were looking forward to combat because we had had all this training, and you get to the point where you really want to see if you can do it and not turn tail and run. And it's kind of a matter of pride on it. And we never got a chance to do that. But I think we would have done all right.
Mm-hmm. Well, was there anything that you did for good luck? Like, you know, four-leaf clover, anything like that?
No, we're St. Christopher Medal, and that was about it, along with my dog tags, and that was about it.
Uh-huh. What is St. Christopher the saint of?
Is it travel? I'm not sure.
Might be. That sounds about right.
I'm not positive on it, but it's supposed to kind of keep you in one piece.
So, did you ever get to go back and finish your school, your college?
No, I didn't. I should have. Because the GI Bill was enacted by Roosevelt in 44 before he died. And that was one of the greatest things that you've ever done for soldiers in this country. Had a much better deal then than the soldiers getting now. I could have gone to college and done anything I wanted to do. And I had always wanted to learn to fly, so I learned to fly. And they paid the whole deal. Besides, gave me, I think, $75 a month. I'm talking too much to live on. And so I just got my private license at that time, private pilot's license. But I could have done, should have gone back to Purdue probably, but I decided, well, I'd seen the world and I wasn't going to do it. My father had a construction business and a hauling business working out of Hazard, Kentucky. We were from here, but his business was located in Hazard. And I went to work for him. And that was back in the days before ever all the country roads were blacktop. They were all macadam, rock surface roads, and you had to put rock on them every year. And so he worked through the Kentucky Stone Company and bid with them. And we rocked about 15 or 20 counties in eastern Kentucky every year. Most of it we had to haul in was brought in on a railroad. Some we could haul right out of the quarry, like up in Beattyville. And did some work in Virginia the same way. And then we decided to get into construction business. And so we bought a couple of dozers, one thing, another. And that was back in the early 50s, I guess. The state came up what they call a 2 cent a mile road. They put a 2 cent tax on gasoline strictly for rural roads. And they started building roads all over places and rebuilding that were bad. And you didn't bid them on a yardage basis. You bid them on a mileage basis, but you knew what the yardage was in, because they had plans, but you just didn't bid so much a yard. You just bid them on a mileage basis, and we did several of those, and we got into the coal stripping a little bit. And I'm sorry now we ever did that after flying over eastern Kentucky and seeing what they've done up there now. This mountaintop removal, I'm sorry to ever have had anything to do with it. But we didn't do too much good at that. Got married in 1948. And we were on a strip job in Scott County, Tennessee, down on Oneida, Tennessee, up the Brimstone Creek. Got married, and we were shipping coal pretty good. We had a couple of dozers down there and a shovel and one thing, another. And went to Canada on a honeymoon and came back. Oneida, I'd rented an apartment my wife had never seen in Oneida, Tennessee. And the market had broken and we were out of business. She never saw the apartment any time, so we went back and went to Hazard. Went to the headquarters and back in construction again.
Okay, let's see. Well, you did say you had been to reunions.
Mm-hmm.
Do you attend reunions, and if so, why?
And what now?
And why? What makes you want to go to a reunion?
Why? Our reunions were good. I say were good because they don't have them anymore. But I didn't find out about the things until about 20 years ago, I guess, 15, 20 years ago, after they'd already had several. And then we've tried to make almost everyone. We've missed a couple since then. Had them in some good places. Niagara Falls, they had them in Virginia, Tacoma, Washington, San Antonio, Minneapolis. And the last one was last year, the year before. We've been thinking about disbanding the division association for several years because we were getting less people every year. We're all no young blood coming in at all, of course. And getting fewer people every year, just weren't able to come. And the last one was in Branson last September. I went, but I started having some heart problems, and I didn't get there. And I still did. And I missed the last one. That one they finally devoted, and they finally got enough things to cancel the whole thing. And so we're not having any more reunions. But you'd see people you hadn't seen for a long time. A lot of them you didn't even remember until you got to talking to each other, because people change. But we really enjoyed that. It gave us a chance to get out and see more of the country and reminisce.
Did you have any close friends that you still talk to from your
yeah.
church?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's
see. I tell you what, you really did a good job of getting all my questions.
Oh.
Trouble
to. Yeah, I got to thinking about all this stuff, and what I could, so I kind of been trying to bring it back.
Well, is there anything that you'd like to add or say that we haven't covered in the interview so far?
Well, I'll just tell you what happened from there. I worked for my father for several years, and then we came to a difference of opinion. He didn't want to get bigger, and I wanted to get bigger. And so then I went with Talbot Construction out of Winchester, who did railroad work and highway work. And this was right at the beginning of the interstate program. And so I worked with Scott Talbot for several years as a grade foreman, and then made superintendent. The last two jobs on, I was superintendent of the jobs, one in West Kentucky, a 9-mile job, and another one, the last one was on, was in Parkersburg, West Virginia, but all interstate. Well, it wasn't interstate in West Kentucky, as a West Kentucky toll road, then around Beaver Dam. After then, Scott decided to sell out. And about that time, my father passed away. And so I was finishing up the job in Parkersburg when he passed away. And then I had a plane up there. So then I flew to Hazard. When they called me, he'd had a massive stroke, and he died before I got there. But then it worked out for me very well, because then I could go in there. I was familiar with it, and I took over his company and finished up his contracts and then sold it out, because I did not want to be in a trucking business. And then I went to work for Bizak Brothers Construction Company for a short while. In the meantime, I was tired of being gone all the time. And so I had been on the airport board that formed the airport out here, that located the airport, helped locate it, helped build it. It had two operators, and neither one of them could make it in this time. This was in 46, I guess. Not 46, 66. And I talked to my wife. I said, why don't we, I had gotten a commercial pilot's license. We didn't have an instrument rating or an instructor's. You want to try this for a year and we'll try it at home. If not, I'll go back to work where I can make a good living in construction. And so she said, yeah, we'll try it for a year. And we stayed there 18 years. And the airport worked out real well. And I did that, and I became a pilot examiner for the FAA. I could give flight tests, issue a license, or thumbs down, either way. And I did it even after I sold out, but my hearing started going back pretty bad in 84. I'm getting my years straight here. And so then I decided to sell out, so I sold out as of January the 1st, 85. but I kept my examiners. I could still give flight tests, one thing. I couldn't do any serious instrument flying or anything like that because you can't take a chance on missing radio communications when your hearing starts bad. Well, it's gotten steadily worse since then. But so then we went to Okeechobee, and I've been down there. We bought a place down there. I've been down there ever since. Now Okeechobee's gone dry. I guess you'd heard about, that or not. Mm-hmm. Terrible shape down there. You can't get out in the lake except with an airboat because the water has receded. Because airboats will run on anything. But you can't get out there in a motorboat except in certain places you can go if you're very, very careful where they've got places dredged out. But it's getting lower all the time. So now we've got a place down there to get rid of.
Well, it sounds like you've had quite an interesting life, for sure.
I couldn't beat it. I've done everything I wanted to do, pretty much. And I'm very, very... Most people can't make a living something they love to do, and I was able to. I like construction work, and I'm crazy about flying. And so, because I started flying one. Mentally, when I was 6 years old, I guess, when Lindbergh crossed the ocean. And I built models, bought kits, and then I designed my own models. And you'd be surprised how much you can learn about aerodynamics from fooling with model airplanes. That really was a big help to me in later life. But I had airplanes and all the trees around Gracie Lake. I was born here in Montgomery County, Gracie Lake.
Well, that seems like a good place to stop, I guess. I'll have you sign the release form we talked about for the interview, and thank you very much for talking to me.
All right, sure, I enjoyed it.
Thanks.
I didn't generally get to talk that much.